Daniel 7. We are moving on to the good part of Daniel. So we had last week a discussion of the four beasts. We saw how chapter 7 really correlates very well with chapter 2, where you've got the statue made of the four metals and you've got the four beasts here. And we noticed a lot of the similarities that existed between the two. But we're going to pick up this morning talking a little bit more about the fourth beast and then the Ancient of Days and the Son of Man as the scenery that Daniel is witnessing in this vision changes. But just to set and open our minds for this study, let's read again chapter 7, verses 1 through 8. Paul, would you read those verses for us, please?
Sure. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head upon his bed. Then he wrote the dream and told the sum of the matters. Daniel spake and said, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven strove upon the great sea. And four great beasts came up from the sea, diverse one from another. The first was like a lion, and had eagle's wings. I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth, and made stand upon the feet as a man, and a man's heart was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second, like to a bear, and it raised up itself one on one side, and it had three ribs in the mouth of it between the teeth of it. And they said thus unto it, Arise, devour much flesh. After this I beheld, and lo, another, like a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings of a fowl. The beast had also four heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, and strong exceedingly, and it had great iron teeth. It devoured and brake in pieces, and stamped the residue with its feet of it, and it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns.
One more verse, please.
I considered the horns, and behold, there came among them another little horn, before whom there were three of the first horns plucked up by the roots, and behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things.
Okay. So what you're going to see throughout the course of Daniel 7 is Daniel looking up, down on earth, looking down on earth, and he's going to be looking up later into heaven, and we're going to see some of the things he witnesses. So his perspective changes a couple times, and you'll catch that probably as you kind of see the scenery change and see what Daniel is describing change a little bit. But this really brings to conclusion the first dream or the first vision that he has recorded for us there. We talked a lot about the four beasts last week, and we identified those as the four great kingdoms that were going to occur. The first being the Babylonian, then the Medo-Persian, which would arise, then the Grecian, and lastly the Roman. And all of this pointing toward, during the day of that fourth kingdom, God was going to set forth a kingdom unlike all others that was going to be eternal in nature, unlike everything else that Daniel's describing in these other kingdoms. But let's talk for a little bit. That last verse we read, verse 8 in chapter 7. This last beast, you'll remember, that Daniel's describing is somewhat different than all of the others. Everything else kind of points toward a known creature, like a lion or a leopard or a bear, something like that. But this fourth beast he describes as being different or diverse than all of the rest. And one of the noticeable differences being this fourth beast, which he isn't able to associate with any other animal that we might recognize, has these 10 horns on its head. And we looked at a passage in Zechariah. When you look at apocalyptic literature, what you find out is that horns were symbolic for power. So you see the actions of the fourth beast as it's devouring with these great iron teeth, and it's stomping and treading about all of its enemies. Also on its head are these 10 horns, which are representative of this great power that it possesses. And what happens is Daniel's watching this vision unfold, and he's watching this beast kind of devour. Three of the horns that this fourth beast has are uprooted, and one small horn or one little horn kind of comes up in its place. And we've talked about what we're reading here in Daniel. This is really some odd stuff, probably similar to dreams that we've had. It just really doesn't make sense when you try to look at it logically. And so we're trying to interpret and determine what it was these things represent, what they symbolize. And so this little horn comes up, uprooting three in the process, and this little horn has eyes, and it has a mouth. And it says with that mouth is speaking pompous things against God. Very unique characteristics, very odd things that Daniel's describing here. And if you look in verse 24 there in Daniel chapter 7, He says here, speaking of this beast, because Daniel's going to inquire a little bit later, he wants to know more about this fourth beast. It's so different, he's going to have some specific questions that he's going to ask an angel regarding this fourth beast. And we find out here, verse 24, that the 10 horns that are on the head of the fourth beast are representative, or 10 kings who shall arise from this kingdom, and another shall arise among them. He shall be different from the first ones, and he shall subdue 3 kings. And so the 10 horns on the head of the fourth beast are representative of the 10 kings of this fourth kingdom. Now, the question is, as I mentioned before, when you're over here in the book of Daniel, especially in the latter portion of the text, where Daniel has these dreams and these visions, a lot of people like to look at this and interpret these things, these meanings, as very literal. They look at it in a very literal eye, and so they would look at this particular passage and they would say, okay, these 10 horns are 10 kings, 10 literal kings, and we understand them to be part of the Roman emperor, 10 literal emperors, Roman kingdom, 10 literal emperors, 10 literal Caesars. And so we're going to talk about that a little more when we get down to verse 24. But just to kind of give you a little heads up as to what that is, 10, remember, once again, it symbolizes completion. And so some have looked at this and some have said, well, it's talking here about the number of emperors that Rome is going to have, specifically in regard to a certain aspect that will later unfold in another vision that Daniel has. Some look at this and say, this is 10 literal emperors that actually reigned in Rome, and it's pointing us toward a specific person we can identify. Okay, so we're going to entertain both of those thoughts as we move forward. We do want to be careful that we don't interpret too much of this literally, but there are perhaps some things history might reveal to us that allow for a more literal interpretation. So when we get further down into the text, we'll make more mention of the 10 horns, the 10 kings, and what that might be pointing toward. If it's pointing toward an individual, or if it's pointing toward more so a group of kings or leaders that are going to arise. So we'll talk more about that when we get down to that verse. But you'll notice here the actions of this little horn. What was it doing? What caught Daniel's eye that this little horn was doing? Very last phrase in verse 8. Okay. Had eyes and it was speaking. And what was the significance of what it was? We're not told what it said, but what was it identified as speaking? Mine says pompous words, New King James. Do we have any other translations that might render that differently?
King James said great.
Okay, great words. Okay. So you get the idea of what Daniel's describing here. Not that just, oddly enough, it has eyes and a mouth and it's speaking, but it's speaking pompous words, it's speaking great words. We're to understand this, once again, these four physical manifestations, these beasts which are representative of kingdoms, this last one has this horn that comes up and is speaking these great words. We understand that to be boastful, not just against man or not just against these other beasts and his superiority, but more directed toward God. And so those pompous words that it was speaking. And when you understand, as we've identified the four beasts, the fourth being the Roman Empire, and you understand a little bit about what history tells us regarding the kings of the Roman Empire, they go above and beyond what several of the other empires throughout history have done regarding their status, you might say, especially after death. The Egyptians, whenever they had a pharaoh or a new pharaoh come into being, it was their understanding that their pharaoh was a son of the gods. And several other cultures, whenever they would have a king arise or a new king come into being, they would identify him as a son of the gods, or perhaps, you know, some affiliation with the gods. However, the Roman emperors really went above and beyond, and it goes back to the Caesar during the days of Jesus, Caesar Augustus, that started off this idea, you know, we're not just sons of the gods, we are gods. And it kind of started with them believing that at their death, they were deified. Or at their death, they passed into becoming a god, or they became gods. In fact, history records a statement made by one of the emperors when he was in the process of dying immediately. He says, oh no, I fear I am becoming a god. And that's the mentality that they had, that when they died, when they departed life, that they entered into this godhood status. And it really transitioned and grew worse and worse. And you see here the pride increasingly becoming worse among these emperors, that not only did they believe that they were gods when they departed life, it got to be the idea that no, We are gods in this life. And this is really going to result with the emperor cult, which we're going to talk a little bit more. We get further down into the chapter where the book of Revelation really highlights a lot of the things there regarding the emperor cult, where essentially the emperor demanded that all of the citizens of Rome and all of its subservience would have to come and pay homage and worship and bow down to the emperor as God. And that's why I say we're looking at these Roman emperors and these pompous words that it was speaking. None of the preceding people before them identified themselves as deity, unlike the Romans. So you see this little horn is speaking these blasphemous words, and once again, we're going to identify them later, maybe as an individual, maybe perhaps as individuals within this emperor cult that deified themselves in this life. So part of those words, those pompous, great, blasphemous words, is speaking against God, is, I am like you. I am a God. And so God sees this, Daniel witnesses this, and we're going to see God's response to this in a little while. Not just that, but you consider these words that were being spoken against God and perhaps his people as well. And you think, both the Jews and the Christians during the Old and during the New Testament suffered at the hands of the Romans. What do we know? What does history tell us about the Romans and the Jews? How did they handle that? How did that really conclude? 70 AD, destruction of Jerusalem, right? You had millions of Jews simply annihilated at the hands of the Romans. And once again, you're painted for us as this picture of the beast is devouring with these great iron teeth and is stomping around, just destroying everything in its wake. And that was the mentality, that was the mode of operation, really, that the Romans used when they governed the earth. And so regarding God's people of old under the old law, the Jews, they were just about destroyed at the hands of the Romans. And you can go back and you can see persecution on the Jews even prior to 70 AD. It just really culminated with the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple and the annihilation of almost the entire Jewish population. Then you carry that into the New Testament, that is God's people under the new law, Christians. They too also suffered very severely under the hands of the Romans. History tells us, and that's a large part of the message of the book of Revelation, is that persecution is coming in chapter 2, those famous words, he who remains faithful unto death will receive the crown of life, pointing toward this great persecution that was going to come on behalf of the Romans. And so we see that God's people, both Jews and Christians, under both covenants, suffered very greatly from this Roman Empire when it came into being, and the persecution. And so you see this horn that comes up, you see these blasphemous words that are being spoken. You really see that manifested not only in the self-deification of the emperor, but also in the persecution of God's people. You know, God, look at what I'm doing to your people. So we see that manifested in both of those instances. Thoughts, comments, or questions on the first 8 verses in Daniel 7? Tommy?
I was reading one commentary that talked about the little horn.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. There are a lot of people that interpret that to be the Catholic Church, and especially the Pope being at the head of that. And we'll talk a little bit more about some of those things as we go further along in our study. That is some people's interpretation. In fact, I think, don't know if I'm going to mention it and what we're going to be looking at today, but I've got several different theories as to who commentators have postulated that this might be. We've got one that I believe fits in really well, but we'll talk about that more when we get down to verse 24. But what we're going to see, you're going to see various potential applications. And scholars have held to all these different views. What you're going to find out as we study through the book of Daniel, there's a lot that we just can't determine with 100% certainty. And so what I'd like to do, hopefully throughout the course of a lot of our study, is just to present to you, these are the various views. These are some of their strengths. These are some of the weaknesses. These are some of the inconsistencies. And when we can speak conclusively, such as we can identifying the four beasts, that's relatively easy to conclude, as history has shown us. We will speak conclusively. But whenever there is, you might say, some inconsistencies in the theories or the thoughts, we'll put those out there, and it'll be up for each individual to decide, okay, what do I believe this is? So maybe that'll prompt you to study a little further on your own to come to that determination. That is a common interpretation regarding this little horn that comes up, the Roman Catholic Church. But you know, also, Tommy, and I haven't really looked into that myself. One of the weaknesses of that being, Paul talks about in 2 Thessalonians, he talks about, I guess, the Antichrist there. Or that's, I shouldn't say a weakness. That really kind of identifies what also some people believe to be the Roman Catholic Church, where you've got this great falling away that occurs, the apostasy, as he refers to it. And some have identified what Paul's speaking of as the Pope as well in the Catholic Church. So a lot of what the New Testament said in the New Testament, particularly the book of Revelation, we'll look later, probably going to be there next week or the week after. It really aligns well with what Daniel's saying here. So that is one of the ideas, and we'll talk more about that later. Any other thoughts on these verses here before we move on?
In the New Testament, Christ is referred to as the horn of salvation.
So interesting.
Could possibly be.
Okay.
Looking forward to
him. Okay. It could be in the power of salvation. You think about horns representative of power. Jesus is the horn of salvation. He's the power of salvation. And you think of what salvation does, it is indeed a powerful, very powerful aspect of what we believe. And so that, once again, kind of reinforces that idea. But Jesus is spoken of in that way. All right, let's continue in our reading. Let's read verses 9 through 14. Ronnie, would you read those for us, please? So you can tell the vision here shifts. Previously, Daniel's looking down at the earth, and he sees these great beasts just rampaging and the various characteristics. And the fourth beast, which catches his eye a little bit. And his scene shifts heavenward. You know, he's no longer looking at the earth. He's looking heavenward. And it kind of describes this scene, we would just say, where he witnesses the Ancient of Days and the Son of Man. We understand this. The language that Daniel uses, this great judgment scene is being set forth, particularly this judgment regarding these four beasts that have been on the earth, who've had this dominion and who've engaged in all of these terrible acts. And this portion of the vision is going to detail many elements from this is taken and used in other judgment scenes you may see that are described for us. Revelation chapter 20, verses 11 and 12. Sometimes I think we may credit John with describing or being the source of these various elements and these strange things. Really, it points back to Daniel. Daniel was really the originator of a lot of things that John talks about in the Revelation. And so this is where these various ideas of a great throne coming down and books being opened, these were first described for us by Daniel regarding the judgment scene. And John borrows from this in Revelation 20, verses 11 and 12. He's talking, John's speaking of final judgment. Daniel's speaking of judgment of these four kingdoms. John says, I saw a great white throne, and him who sat on it, from whose face the earth and heaven fled away, and there was found no place for them. I saw the dead, small and great, standing before God, and books were opened, and another book was opened, which is the book of life, and the dead were judged according to their works by the things that were written in the books. And so he uses borrows some of the similarity or some of the symbolism that Daniel first used back here in chapter 7 regarding final judgment. This idea of a throne being sat down, and you know, God, of course, sitting on this throne, heaven and earth flees from his presence as he sits there, and this book is opened up that has the deeds, and each individual has their book that contains the deeds of their life, and on the basis of what's written in their book, they're judged. And that really points back a lot to what Daniel described, what Ronnie just read for us. As Daniel describes this great judgment scene. This idea, I think you're reading from the King James Version, right, Ronnie? It says, the first phrase it uses regarding these thrones, it says, thrones were cast down. That translation, particular translation, might cause a little bit of confusion as to what was being placed. The ESV translates that, the thrones were put in place. And so the idea that Daniel's trying to paint for the readers is that this throne scene was being put in place. And so you've got the thrones that are being set out, and God eventually is going to come and sit on this throne. You read it as thrones being cast down. Perhaps that's how they would have understood it during the days in which the King James uses that language. We understand it more so as this judgment scene being placed or laid out before us. So these thrones were put down. Then the Ancient of Days took his seat. So there you have the verse right there for you, all nice and neat and laid out. And there's the Revelation verse that I just read. So I'm just wasting a couple slides on that. So we talk a little bit about here the Ancient of Days that Daniel describes for us in verse 9. Let's just ask this question. Who is the Ancient of Days? And describe his appearance. Okay. God. more specifically, which personality, which entity?
God the Father.
Okay. I think we see God the Father described for us here. So he's referred to as Daniel as the Ancient of Days. And not necessarily a name, more so what that is that description. It's describing one who is ancient in days. You go back to Exodus chapter 3 and verse 14. Do you remember how God says, you know, this is my name. This is who you shall tell the children of Israel sent you to deliver them from bondage. Remember what he said? How did he describe himself there? Two words. I am. So this idea of God being the I am, pre-existing this world and time and everything that we know, he is before. He has no beginning. He has no end. And so, described here for us in Daniel as the Ancient of Days, once again just reinforces what we know about God, that he is eternal, he has no beginning, he has been forever. And he's described as having this white garment, this white hair. What do you think that might be representative of?
Purity.
Purity, holiness, righteousness, also the longevity, the fact that a white hair symbolizes, is representative of his age. And he's sitting on this throne, and there's this fiery flame. We understand fire often to be representative of judgment. You know, we're told that Jesus is described as going to baptize with the Holy Spirit and with fire. So the fires of judgment that are going to be coming, and especially when you read through this, and you see that it's for this reason that God has placed this throne here, and he sat down on it to make judgment on these four kingdoms that have been terrorizing the earth, or that have been on the earth, and particularly a special judgment for this fourth beast here and his horn, which has spoken these pompous words. And you see the Ancient of Days, as Daniel describes him, he's surrounded, he's referred to as the Lord of hosts, the Lord of many. And you see this idea that's being painted, these innumerable spiritual hosts that are surrounding God on his throne. And I think I've got a passage here. Yeah, Micaiah from 1 Kings chapter 22 also kind of describes for us a similar scene as Daniel in Daniel 7. Micaiah says, "Therefore hear the word of the Lord, a vision he saw. I saw the Lord sitting on his throne and all the hosts of heaven standing by on his right hand and on his left." And so when you see God refer to himself as the Lord of hosts, or you have this picture of judgment painted here in Daniel 7, you see God sitting on the throne and God is surrounded by this innumerable spiritual hosts that perhaps serve in some various form in his court as advisors or so forth and so on. And so as Daniel witnesses this great judgment scene, you see the angelic court there that was surrounding the Ancient of Days. You see then this book that was opened. And throughout the Bible we have various recordings of a book that God possessed. And in this situation, the book is here, is open as judgment is soon to take forth. Perhaps this, in this book contained are things God's purpose for the world and for judgment and for humanity. And you know, in all of these books, God has one that belongs to particularly to him, that he's about to open up and he's about to make judgment, no doubt, the book of these various beasts or these various kingdoms that had been on the earth. And the message is, as you read through this, what's really going to trouble Daniel is the fact that this particular fourth beast that's making war, as we're going to find out, on the saints, on the people of God, and it appears for a moment that this fourth beast is winning, that perhaps the saints of God might be defeated by the power and the might of this fourth beast. But then you go back and you remember the vision of the judgment that takes place. God's got these things recorded. They're in this book. He hasn't forgotten his people. Judgment is going to be brought to the one who makes war on the saints of God. And so you have there the judgment that occurs on the four beasts. Verse 12 kind of outlines that we read. The rest of the beasts, they had their dominion taken away and their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. And so I know we're looking at this kind of out of order. Daniel, as he writes this down, deals first with the judgment on the fourth beast and then talks about the judgment on the other three beasts as well. But we're going to kind of look at this backwards, since chronologically the three beasts, the Babylonian, Medo-Persian, and Grecian came first, and then look just a moment at his judgment on the fourth. He identifies God's judgment on these particular beasts, these first three. It says their dominion, that is, what they possessed, that was taken away. And we'd already seen this happen in the book of Daniel with King Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon. They had a lot of the known world at that point in time, at least as it pertained to God's people. That was taken away from Nebuchadnezzar. that was given to the Medo-Persians. As they arose, they received the dominion that the Babylonians previously had. Now, this judgment that these first three beasts receive, their dominion is going to be taken away. Yet their lives were prolonged, we're told, for a season and a time. So we see God taking from each of these subsequent kingdoms, taking their dominion, giving that to another. And he's going to allow them to exist for a certain period of time. And you talk a little bit about it. You follow history through these various kingdoms. You find out that although they lose their dominion, they're not by any means annihilated. They do continue to exist, although not with the power and the land and the dominion that they previously had. Yet they're able to maintain, you might say, a recognized identity. And so that's what Daniel's describing here, God's judgment on these first three. And remember, what they're doing is not nearly as bad or nearly as evil as what God sees this fourth beast doing. So he takes away their dominion, but he allows them to exist for a period of time, you might say. However, this fourth beast suffers a unique fate, and Daniel describes that in verse 11, which is prior to the verse we just looked at. But chronologically, this would occur after the first three beasts remove their dominion and just kind of shrink into the shadows of history. Fourth beast receives specific judgment. I watched then because, and notice, this is because of the sound of the pompous words. So once again, just like Belshazzar brought about the downfall of the Babylonians because of the feasting that he did, it sounds a lot like God's bringing this judgment on this fourth beast because of the speaking of the pompous words of the little horn. I watched because of the sound of the pompous words while the horn was speaking. I watched till the beast was slain and his body destroyed and given to the burning flame. And so you see that the fourth beast suffers a unique fate or a unique judgment. While the previous three had their dominion taken away but continued to exist, God judges the fourth beast very harshly. What exactly this judgment entails, because as you follow Rome throughout its history, it too seems to shrink back to society, into the shadows of history, you might say. But something I think that's unique that Daniel's describing here, at least he's bringing this to the forefront of the mind of the readers, because during the days of this fourth beast, they're going to suffer very greatly. God's people are going to suffer very greatly. And I think God wants these people to understand, yes, while these other beasts are going to be judged, this fourth beast has transgressed everything else the others have done. And so God highlights a particular aspect of judgment that this fourth beast is going to undergo. Not only is it going to be, its dominion is going to be removed, it's no longer going to, at the point in time in which God has determined, it's going to lose its dominion, and that's going to be removed. You see it here suffering the judgment of fire. And I think what God's highlighting there is more so the eternal judgment that the individuals that persecuted God's people are going to experience. Now, granted, you look at those other three kingdoms, they weren't near as persecuting as the Roman Empire was. And so I think in seeing this vision, the fourth beast suffers a unique fate in that the torment that he caused on God's people is going to be repaid him tenfold and beyond. That is eternal condemnation because of his particular transgression against God's people. And so you see his judgment described in a little more detail and is a little more horrific than you do these previous beasts. So we're just about out of time. I don't want to jump into the next portion. We're going to talk next week a little bit about the Son of Man and the kingdom that the Son of Man receives, and then we'll move on to further questions that Daniel has regarding this dream. Anyone have any thoughts or any comments or questions they'd like to add to the first little bit of the judgment scene with the Ancient of Days that we've read so far? Okay, we'll pick up next week then with the Son of Man as he receives this eternal kingdom during the days of the fourth. So thank you.